And I wouldn't have it any other way, would you?
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have in the studio Andre F. Pelletier. Andre, welcome to WCBN. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is fantastic.
It's fantastic to see you. It really is. Thanks to Jason Voss for being here, engineering behind the glass today, making us sound good, or sound at all, really, to be quite honest.
Make me sound good. You're going to have a lot of work ahead of you.
Nah, you're too modest, Andre. But I wanted to say, before we get started with the conversation today with Andre Pelletier about his book of poems, Petoskey Stones, out with Finishing Line Press just this September, is just to say thank you all for tuning in. I appreciate it. And I hope that you're doing okay out there, because I know today is a hard day. And right now, I should say I'm speaking for myself and not for WCBN-FM. I'm not speaking for the University of Michigan. I'm not speaking for the Board of Regents, certainly, for the University of Michigan. I just know that today is a day that it may not be. I don't know, Andre, if I don't need to pull. You don't feel like you need to be pulled into this if you don't
I'm
want
happy
to be
pulled.
But I feel like it's not, somehow today isn't as shocking as 2016 was, but it feels worse.
Yes.
Which is almost thinking, if there was a time machine, unimaginable to kind of contemplate from that time even. And I just want everyone out there to please take care of yourselves. And if you can, if you have energy, take care of those who are close to you geographically, and maybe reach out to those that you love who are far away. But Andre, what were you going to say?
I've always loved the pomp of election day, staying up and watching the returns.
Like the Super Bowl of politics?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not really a sports person too much.
So this is what you had.
This is it.
Yeah, that and some maybe music.
The
Grammys.
No. I remember watching the 1980 returns with my parents when I was little.
Yeah, because you're a Gen Xer, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I was six, and I didn't know who Carter and Reagan really were. I knew the names, and I knew who my parents were supporting. And I knew partway through the evening they were really getting bummed. But that's about all I knew. Although ever since then, I've just loved the watching, the celebration of Election Day, you know. And so 2016.
Well, is it because Election Day is something different? Because it means that you're actually showing your right to vote.
Yes.
as your civic right and civic duty to be part of the process and the grand experiment of democracy.
Right. Now,
in this republic.
So I've always taken, you know, watching the returns as sort of a party. In 2016, I was home alone that evening. I ordered a pizza and I got a six pack, and I was like, "Oh, this is going to be great! I'm going to sit here and eat my pizza and drink a couple of beers and have a blast."
Was it like a craft brew, or was it?
Oh, I don't remember what it was offhand, but I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it was of some sort. It was probably a Bell's, but I don't know.
Nice.
And you know, about 10:30, it became clear that it was time to switch to something stronger. And last night, it wasn't as surprising. Except we'd already been through it once. Like, I thought we'd learned, you know. We'll see.
We'll see.
I saw the phrase last night that I'd never heard before. nauseously optimistic. And I thought, yes, that that makes sense.
Oh, well, okay. So, Andre, thanks again for coming down to the station today and being here with us at WCBN. And thanks for bringing your poems.
Oh, absolutely.
Today will be a good day, I think, for poems. And we won't keep talking about this, because I also think in some ways we need to also have breaks, I think, from the onslaught of...
After, the day after Election Day in 2016, I started writing a list of things that I do like about the United States, what I love about the country.
Yes.
And it turned out, went on to a seven page list of just stuff I love. And I've still got it saved. I mean, there's nothing to do with it because it's just a list of things I like. But
do you have it with you?
No,
on your phone?
But I remember, it's random stuff, the national parks or
Definitely.
Spike Lee movies, stuff.
Yes.
And it kind of helped me.
Art.
Yeah,
art for one thing. Let's also
reevaluate the moment and looking for something positive, maybe, when I was scared.
Yes.
Having been through it once now, I think the fear is a little more precise, maybe, because we've already seen it.
Have you started making the list?
have
you started listing?
I worked all day.
Maybe tonight.
Maybe
tonight. Yeah. Yeah. Instead of counting sheep.
Right.
Okay, but to the poems. To the poems we go. And the latest book of yours, Andre, is Petoskey Stones, out with Finishing Line Press, just this September, as I said before. And before we go any further, I'll read your short bio, which is in the back of the book, as is our thing here. Andre F. Pelletier is a Pushcart and Best of the Net nominated poet, and a lecturer 3 at Eastern Michigan University, where he teaches literature and writing. He lives in Ypsilanti, Michigan, with his wife and children. His poetry has recently appeared in various publications, both online and in print. His debut poetry collection, Poplandia, is a collection of pop culture-based poems. In his free time, he obsesses over soccer and comic books. And we have Poplandia on the table with us. And Andre, you brought another. Could you tell us about the other books that we have on the table, in addition to Petoskey Stones?
Petoskey Stones just came out, as you said. Poplandia was 2022. In 2023, my book, Trouble on the Escarpment, came out. It's a very small print run from a small publisher in London that does everything by hand. They're called Backroom Poems, and I think literally they put everything together in the back room of their office.
It's a beautiful printing.
They're really cool and kind of, punk rock sort of do it, DIY stuff.
Definitely.
But because it was such a small run, they also then let me put it in my other book that came out last year from Alien Buddha, Ambassador Bridge, which is, rather than the pop culture stuff of Poplandia, it's more political, social, environmental kind of stuff.
And really connected to this place, because we know the Ambassador Bridge.
Right.
And we know Petoskey Stones.
Yes. Petoskey Stones is about growing up in northern Michigan. I grew up in Petoskey, so there were Petoskey Stones everywhere. It's just sort of nostalgic stuff about childhood in Michigan and some more recent stuff, but...
When did you find yourself writing? When did you go to memory and thinking of childhood specifically, Andre?
Well, I can almost date it exactly. I was at a park with my kid, and we were up in a tree, and I was thinking about climbing trees up north when I was a kid. And then I got a text from an old friend that I hadn't seen in years, but he happened to be my next-door neighbor when we were kids. And so we started talking about the old days while I was up in this tree, and he asked me if I ever wrote about that kind of stuff. And I thought, I haven't, but that's a good idea. And I went home and wrote a poem that's in this book. It's called When War Broke Out, and it's about...
Do you want to read that one?
Yeah, I can read that one.
Thank you.
Let me find that one. Page 15. When War Broke Out. On the edge of the gully grew three old apple trees, stately and gnarled, the remnants of some ancient grove or orchard, at one time sweet and juicy, now the size of golf balls and sour as the day was long. We climbed and ate nonetheless. Hours we spent in those trees, hours we spent hiding in the leaves. In spring, the blossoms bent boughs and filled the air with our stately perfume. Like snow after a blizzard, white blooms blanketed the canopy and consumed creation with autumnal nectar. But it was summer, and we climbed. It was during those long golden days we perched with robins and jays atop the greenery. We were drawn to those lofty treetops, all of the children in the neighborhood compelled to make it higher than the day before, higher than our friends. Some were giants, while others were a tangled mess of honeysuckle or lilac. We conquered them all, hand over hand, but those twisted apples always beckoned. Sometimes, in early fall, war broke out. 10 kids within the trees, 10 in the adjacent field, and the apples were launched, volley after volley. Hours passed as we played at combat. No winners or losers, just bruised children and bruised apples. In the end, mice and worms would feast as we were called home at dusk. There you go.
Thanks, Andre.
Yes, absolutely.
So that poem came out of talking to your friend.
Yeah.
And you went back, so the images came to you.
And this would have been maybe 2018, 2017. And I got more back. I got back into writing more then after that. That sort of, like, I'd always been writing poetry since high school, but this is when I first started taking it more seriously and thinking maybe I could actually do something. And so,
what did you write? What did you write in high school?
Bad.
it's like a rite of passage.
Political stuff mainly. I was listening to really leftist music and reading some more radical stuff, and so I started writing. We were in the Persian Gulf War at the time, and dealing with the Bush Quayle administration. Things seemed really bad at the time, but in hindsight, apparently they can get worse.
Yes, and you were listening to, because you mentioned in the present book, Petoskey Stones, like Public Enemy. And
always. There were a few years when I listened to a lot of Public Enemy. I still do occasionally, and I've taught at Eastern since 1998. And I've taught a lot of African-American literature classes, and I almost always include some Public Enemy lyrics.
Because of the artistry, because they're powerful.
Yeah, I've always loved them. Kid next door to me turned me on to them when we were freshmen in high school, and their second album had just come out. He's also the kid that turned me on to comic books, for a few years, like that's all we did, listen to political hip hop or read comics.
And why do you think like as a kid growing up, a young person in Petoskey, Michigan, how did this kind of feed you? Like, how did you know that it was something that you needed?
Well, first of all, by the time I was in high school, we had moved to Metro Detroit.
Ah, okay.
So I wasn't in Petoskey anymore, but I did get into, like, I was listening to LL Cool J in Petoskey, and I don't know how that happened. I think he was on Saturday Night Live or something one night, and I was like, oh, this is weird. I got to look into this. So it was not like anything on the radio up north. It was all hair metal, hair bands, or easy listening. I don't even think we had any country stations up there. Or, Christian rock. I'm sure now there's all over the rural Michigan's full of that. But, it was all pop stations. And suddenly there was this other kind of thing out there. And I guess that's what got me into it. And I'd always been skeptical of the world, even at a young age, I think.
It sounds like when you shared one of your early memories of like 1980, watching the returns with your folks were progressive in
yes.
their time in that place in Petoskey.
Oh yeah, we every year, every fall when I was a kid, we went to the Emmett County Democratic fundraiser pig roast. It was at this woman's farm. And, you know, my dad was active. My mom was active. And there was probably 30 people at this thing every fall, like of the entire county. There weren't a whole lot of people coming out to the Democratic Party fundraiser, that's for sure. But we went every year, and I hated it because I didn't know anybody, and I was, you know, in elementary school. It was horrible. It was so boring. But in hindsight, I think, oh, that was kind of a formative thing.
Right. It's strange how sometimes the things that you maybe, like, it is, like, you can't know what's going to be formative. I guess, and good and bad, right? Because we're all surrounded by so much that we're conditioned by that sometimes we are not even able to question it because we're so conditioned by it. But this is actually the positive.
Right,
looking back at
right,
that pig,
right.
Big roast was actually something that turned out. But so you got to Detroit.
Yeah, we were in Canton. When the summer before my freshman year of high school, we moved to from Petoskey to Canton. And that's where my neighbor got me into comics and political hip hop. And I'd also been like, you know, when I was in middle school, I'd gone through my dad's record collection and there was, you know, like Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul and Mary and that kind of stuff from when he was younger.
Yes. Protest music.
And I don't think he'd bought an album since. Everything was old like that. There was nothing newer. But there was a lot of Phil Oakes records. You know, lots of stuff like that, and soundtracks, all the old show tunes. But that's how I got into Bob Dylan, and that sort of by the time I was in high school, and we had this kind of political hip hop, and there was, you know, I was listening to the early Dylan, the political stuff back then,
which is also fully narrative as well.
Yes, absolutely,
and lyrical, and you couldn't put another word in probably if you tried.
No, fully deserving of the Nobel Prize.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, completely. Okay, let's take a break, Andre. Today on Living Writers, Andre F. Peltier is here. His book on the table with us, Petoskey Stones. We've got Jason behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today, we've got Andre F. Peltier here in the studio. His book, Petoskey Stones, Poems, out with Finishing Line Press. And so, thanks for choosing songs for today.
Absolutely. One of my favorite hobbies.
And so this song, I thank you for playing it now, Jason. Just absolutely perfect. It takes you back to the being in like the high school.
Yeah, this is particularly that song. It was one of the first songs that I ever heard that I really noticed, like, the sonic aspect of it, where, like, Chuck D's vocals are on one channel and Flavor Flav's are coming through on the other. So when you're listening to it, like, on headphones, you hear their voices coming from different spots. And they're sometimes they're doubling their vocals, but sometimes they're not necessarily saying the same thing. So you get different words, and they're playing and how the words play together and sound while they're kind of almost talking over one another in a fascinating way. Plus, it's got that, you know, really cool take on Black Radical Politics. Yes. Listening to that song, I was like, oh, who are these people? So then, you know, I had to go, oh, who's Huey Newton? Who's Bobby Seale? What was all this stuff? And it really got me hooked on that stuff.
Yeah, because it leads you to more, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So then you have this opening into something, and then you can discover.
Yeah.
And, like, investigate, right?
And the lyrics were always at the forefront of their music. Where there was always a message, sometimes a little too didactic or on the nose, but fascinating and definitely not afraid standing up to the system.
I think that is also key. And the thing that I feel like right now, it feels so good to hear, not afraid to stand up against the system.
Yes.
Or so. So earlier in the first quarter, Andre, you had mentioned that in 2018, you know, you were up a tree with your kid in the park, happened to talk to a friend, came home, wrote a poem about the apple trees in growing up, and this vivid moment. And then that you thought, oh, maybe I could do something with this. And you'd been teaching at EMU. Also, you said then, since, you know, 10 years then, because since
20 years.
Oh, 20 years. 20 oh, my years. God. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Sorry.
we can say time, 10. We'll say 10.
I mean, time goes by, doesn't it?
So fast.
Yes. So, and you had said 1998, right? Was your beginning as a teacher at EMU.
Right.
And teaching literature and creative writing.
Literature and writing.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so when you say maybe I could do something with this, is this when you started writing more regularly and then sending it out to online journals? Because on your website, you have a host of online publications. What is that like?
Well, at the beginning of, I guess it was the fall of the pandemic, I got an email from some publisher saying, hey, do you have a manuscript? You can send it to us. We'd love to see it. And I thought, no. But then, I've got a bunch of stuff. I could probably put I bet there's enough here. So I put it together and I sent it off, and they didn't want it. But I realized how easy the submission process was. And so using the submission website.
How did they reach out to you?
I have no idea. I don't know. They must have just, like, you know, I was on some listserv or, you know, as an English teacher.
But had you started posting your poems to some of the...
No, I'd never showed anybody. My family didn't really know that I was writing poetry as often as I was. I showed my wife. I was like, hey, someone's publishing one of my poems. And she was like, you're what? What are you talking about?
Yay.
she still hasn't read a ton. but that's fine. And so... I realized how easy it was to submit stuff, and so I started submitting more at that point. And there were two things that happened. One, the realization that, you know, the idea, I guess, that I didn't think my stuff was good enough was up against the sudden realization that there's a lot of stuff that's getting published that I don't like. And so there's probably an audience for everything, right? That even if I'm not comfortable with it, or if I think, this isn't as good as this other thing, somebody might like it, so why not try? And then you start getting rejections, and once you do it enough, the rejections kind of bounce off. You know, like, at first I was like, oh, I really thought this one was going to work, but then I realized, like, why should I have had any faith like that? There's 1,000-1,500 people submitting poems to this journal, you know, and they're taking 20 of them. Like,
right.
The odds aren't great.
Right.
And there's all sorts of reasons they're rejecting them, whether it's stylistic differences or it just doesn't fit the theme that they're looking for, or, you know, whatever. So it's
or
not
how
just...
many of the 1,000 that a person's read on a given day, because
right.
I think poems can be like scent, like smells.
Yeah.
Once, if you have so many, sometimes it's hard to have a fresh take on it.
Yeah. So... You know, it was like, maybe they don't like him, or maybe there's some other reason. And, you know, all the rejection letters are so formulaic that you never know. They're like, oh, thank you. We really enjoyed it, but it doesn't fit us this time. Well, whatever. Maybe, maybe not. But.
And it didn't stop you.
No, because once it happened a few times, it just didn't faze me anymore, you know, and I can get a rejection letter in my email every week. And I was like, all right, you know, I put it in my file of rejections and that's fine. And then somebody said, hey, we're looking for a collection of pop culture based stuff. And I thought, oh, I've got a bunch of stuff. I could put that together. And I, you know, I spent an afternoon organizing it into one file and sending it off. And he accepted it. And that was
Poplandia.
Poplandia. So that would have been winter of 2022 because it came out September 2022. So it'd been about a year and a half. And I made this New Year's resolution. This year, I'm going to try and get a book out because I had a bunch of stuff that had been online and things and in some print journals. And then it actually happened. And it was shocking. And it was fascinating. And it was so exciting.
Oh, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
That is really exciting. Well, what was it like? Because we heard about sort of the darker days, like how you have to be maybe get past the point of being fazed by rejection. So what was it like? What was your first online journal that where it was you placed a poem out in the world? What was that like? And yeah. And was it one that became part of Poplandia or hard
no,
to say?
No, it was a poem about my kid called For a Child Who Is Also a Cactus. and, you know, my kid was struggling with some, you know, social stuff at school and... Oh,
the prickly...
Yeah, yeah.
Part.
And this journal, this poetry journal that does stuff with psychology and neurodiversity wanted it. And I thought, oh my goodness. And, you know, and I told my wife, hey, someone's publishing my poem. And like I said, you're what? What are you talking about? And so then I showed my family and they were excited, I guess, you know, this one does, as one gets at that in a situation like that.
And then how did you decide where to start sending them? Did you like read other books of poems and see where people submitted them? Or
there's
what was your
a couple of things. One was that, you know, read a book of poetry. And if when I like it, you can look at the acknowledgments and see where their stuff's been published. Just being on social media and following the journals and waiting for them to be like, hey, we're accepting submissions this month. And I'm like, okay, I'll see what they like and I'll try and find something. And then there's a website that sort of organizes lots of submissions for all sorts of different journals, and it's really easy to use. So I was using that.
Is that what is that?
Submittable.com.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really easy. I don't have any like skin in their game or anything, but I don't want to plug them necessarily. but they're really easy to use. Lots and lots of rejections. You know, probably 20 to 1. I don't remember the last acceptance I've actually had. It's been a while.
Then there's one coming down the pike, no doubt.
One would hope. Yeah. So it was great. It's been fun.
And how did the print run in the small press in the UK come about? Could you talk a little bit about?
Okay. This book is Trouble on the Escarpment, or chat book. It's, you know, like 20 pages long or something. It doesn't even have page numbers.
But it's got a great tactile quality to it. It's got a single staple as the binding, but a nice like harder paper cover, good quality inside sheets. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can tell the art on the outside too, that they care.
Yes, I think so. And they were great. You know, there was a submission call online. I sent off some stuff. They wanted chat books of politically and socially conscious poetry. So I put stuff together and I sent it and they wanted it. And like I said, it was a small run. They did 50 copies. They sent me 15. They sent like 5 or 10 off to reviewers and things in England and they sold some on their website. And that was it.
Do you want to read one?
Sure. This will be good, I think. Kind of short. The first time I read this in public was at a really small reading. Nobody showed up except for a few friends of mine and my friend and one of my friend's daughters. And I'll talk about that, her reaction in a second. The Age of Conquest. North of Hawaii, the currents converge, conspiring with the sea-strewn wastes to bring about our first plastic island – Lost in Pacific doldrums, we wash up like Ginger and Marianne on the shores of the Great Garbage Patch. We use water bottles and shopping bags to create radios. We listen to the news of NASA and signal the satellites with SOS messages spelled in styrofoam. We build our huts from takeout cartons, sticky white rice, chop suey, egg foo young. We wait for rescue only to return and extend our island's footprint. We reclaim the water for conquest, the seabird's nest and our ever-increasing archipelago, maintaining our dominance we never learn.
Thank you.
That is an island of garbage in the ocean that is not equated with Puerto Rico in any way whatsoever.
Exactly.
And so I read this. And
it's the plastics floating islands that are out there already.
It's so big. It's so crazy. I read this and my friends liked it, but their daughter, who's just out of college, said, "I like it, but who are Ginger and Marianne?"
She didn't know Gilligan's Island.
And I thought, maybe I need to, if I'm on a... And it kind of made me realize maybe my references were outdated in a lot of things.
I know. We were just, we're going to take a short break as we ponder the meaning of 20 years and Gilligan's Island. Okay.
Right.
Today on Living Writers, André F. Pelletier is here with his book, Petoskey Stones. And we just heard a poem from Upon the Escarpment.
Trouble
on the Escarpment. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm glad you did. Today on Living Writers, André F. Pelletier is here, his book, Petoskey Stones, on the table with us. And we just got to hear a little Dylan, who we were talking about earlier in the program, too. So that song, André, you were like,
I could just see. So good. So good. I think the first time I heard it, the first time I paid attention to it was at a Grateful Dead concert, and they covered it. And I went out the next day and got a copy of Highway 61 and just listened to that song over and over and over. And then this version that was playing is from his Bootleg Series Volume 4 Live 1966 version. That's just so good. The first disc is all acoustic and beautiful. And then the second disc with the band, it's just so loud, like nothing, maybe, louder than the Rolling Stones, louder than Zappa was at the time, just noise. And must have been, everybody was upset, supposedly.
Oh, right.
But it must have been shocking to have that kind of volume coming off the stage.
Because that happened in England, didn't it? In London with that show.
That one was actually in Manchester, I think.
Oh, it was Manchester. Yeah. Oh, figures. But, yeah. Manchester. Yeah. Such a good, it's like the Stonehenge of music in some ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks to Jason for picking that particular version of the song, too.
And I've sung that song to my kid at bedtime. Probably to all my kids. Over the years, my oldest is 25, my youngest is 7, and I've been singing that song to them all this time. Love it.
Oh, well, shout out to the kids and the whole family. I also wanted to tell you, I loved how one of the first stories I think you started off by telling was just sort of casually saying when you were up a tree I think that is so great, because I think, how often do you think, you know, when's the last time I climbed a tree, when I was last up a tree? And sometimes as we get older, that can happen. I feel like I've said this probably before on a show, so everyone forgive me if you happen to hear me thinking about this, but those moments where you don't know, oh, this is the last time I climbed a tree, and then, I'm thinking of going to Bird Hills and having a climb, I think, sometime soon. Maybe before the ice.
Yeah. Don't do it during the ice. Yeah. And now that was, like I said, maybe 2018 or so. My youngest was born in 2017. And the difference, I think, between climbing a tree with a kid, with my kid who was in elementary school then, and when my youngest is like, come on, Dad, let's play. It's different. I'm like, I don't know if I can anymore. I used to get down on the floor for hours. Now if I get down, I'm only down for hours because I can't get back up.
You need some like full-on yoga mat support or
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely.
Something. Well, I really feel like there's also a poem in there, I feel like this move to humor and storytelling seem to come out. I mean, this book, Petoskey Stones, for me reading it, it was definitely, we were placed into memory and places, although you moved across Michigan. Mm-hmm. We didn't stay quite in northern Michigan. We moved, right? Getting closer, like you said, to Canton, Metro Detroit, right?
Right, right.
But what is it about place? Like, do you find yourself kind of going to that? You said social justice as well.
Mm-hmm. As far as place, I don't know if this is, I would imagine this is common for most for people, but maybe not. You know, I'm drawn to the places that where I have, you know, these memories. You know, I still love to go up north, but the Petoskey area. When I was young, my grandparents lived on a small island in Tampa Bay, and I read a lot about vacations in Florida as a kid and that area. When my wife and I got married, we went out to some national parks out west in, you know, Utah, California.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful
Arizona.
Land.
And I write a lot about that. It's like sort of like places I feel like I have some kind of connection to. And there's lots of memories about those in relation to those places. So you can, there's a lot to draw on, I guess.
As you get older, are you finding that memories are what you're concerned with when you're thinking of, when you're sitting down to write? And what does your process look like now? Because you are still teaching, and teaching takes time and energy and probably informs your poems too.
I mean, part of it came out of teaching really closely, that the teaching poetry and realizing, you know, if I look at an anthology of poetry, there's a lot more that I don't like than I like, but you know, I'll try and teach some of everything, whether I like it or not. Cause some, you know, it's, we got to cover different periods and different styles. And I guess that it does come out of lots of things like that.
So with your, because I do feel like I probably asked you like five questions in that last question.
Yeah, there was something missed. But
no fault of yours, not to worry. And sometimes it's funny when I start asking a question, I think the person can make it their own.
Right.
But yeah. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best way sometimes. But with teaching, then let's return to that for a little bit, because you've been teaching literature and working with language. And we've been talking about how Public Enemy, the lyrics in that, Bob Dylan, the lyrics and the music of that, like always being connected, it sounds like, to art and literature. Like that was a value you had. What drew you to that? Because you've made a life of it. And then you say you wrote poems when you were much younger, but then kind of came back to it when you were older.
Right. I would say, you know, and I've sort of never really stopped, but started taking it much more seriously, I guess, in the last 5 or 10 years. Let's see. I guess the connection between music and my job, you know, listening, growing up in high school, listening to the more sort of, I don't know, politically aware stuff. So then in college, when I started taking those kinds of classes, and then in grad, and as a lecturer at Eastern, teaching things like African-American lit, I met KRS-One from Boogie Down Productions a few years ago. And one of the main things I had to say to him was, like, you're kind of responsible in a roundabout way for my career. You know, like, he got me interested in this sort of stuff so early.
So it sounds like it, what sparked for you became like critical thinking in relation to this music.
Yeah.
And so you found your way in because you wanted to also, you wanted to amplify what you were seeing in this art and study
it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I got to give KRS-One a copy of a book I had an essay in. It was a graphic novel by the guy that did the cover art for Poplandia. I gave it to him. He's like, why are you giving me this? I was like, well, because one, I think you'll dig it. And two, because I kind of want to thank you for being such a big influence on my life. But not just him, you know. That whole generation of musicians and writers and people coming out of that era.
And how often do you get to see someone
so rare.
And say that? And also, nice for him too. It actually, talking about the cover of Poplandia, it reminds me of Petoskey Stones. I wanted to ask you about the art and how, because with Finishing Line Press, you got to choose your cover,
yes.
Right? What's it like working with Finishing Line Press? What was the experience
like? They said
like?
They would come up with something if I wanted them to, but I had this in mind. The cover art was a painting by a woman named Julie Stanton. She lives in Walloon. And we went to elementary and middle school together, and we became friends on Facebook, you know, more recently. And I said, hey, you know, I've got a new book coming out. Could I use one of your paintings? And I expected her to come back with something like, yeah, $500, no problem. And I was going to say, well, I can't do that, you know. But she said, oh, yeah, great. Choose whichever one you want. I'd be honored to let you do that. So that's fine. And I was like, wait, you mean for free? And she said, yeah. I thought, oh, amazing. And so this just seemed like such a perfect piece of art. You know, it's from that area. It's from somebody I grew up with. And it's beautiful. She's so good.
Are these sumacs?
Yeah.
Then
the painting is called Autumn Sumac. And I'm glad we get to talk about this briefly because... But my one concern about the book, well, my biggest concern, is on the publication page, they didn't actually include her name. There's a blank space that says, insert artist's name here. Julie Stanton is her name, and she's fantastic.
And I feel like there was maybe you got a chance.
Yeah, it's in the acknowledgements.
It is, yes, yeah.
Or the thank you part.
Yeah. For the use of her, Julia A. Stratton, for the use of her amazing artwork on the cover. Yes. So I actually thought maybe this was like but you've told them now though, so that for subsequent printings, they can fill it in, right? Oh,
yeah.
Good. Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
As soon as I got the books, I looked and when I saw that was wrong, I emailed them. I said, I don't know what we can do because they've all been printed and I've got 50 books sitting here in front of me. And they said, we've never made that mistake before. I don't know. So we just sort of go about it. And I told her, I said, hey, I'm really sorry. Your name didn't end up there.
But now, shout out to Julie
she's
her
good.
Beautiful art. And it's
you know, she's wearing her Van Gogh influence on her sleeve. When you look at this, you know, you can see the thick oil.
And the colors are orange, reds, greens, and the blues of the sky. So what was it like working with Finishing Line Press? How did this come to be?
They've been great. They're it came to be in the same way that a lot of them just sort of, I sent the manuscript out to a bunch of places and they're the ones that liked it.
Was it during their open reading or so?
It was definitely a call for manuscripts. I don't know. There was probably a reading fee or something. I don't recall. maybe 10 or 15 bucks or something along with the manuscript.
I think online it says then, but they have a also a solid turnaround time, like so to 3 to 6 months, so you can kind of keep moving with it. Or
And so it was, we'd like to do this if you're still into it. I said, absolutely. they said, you know, do you have any cover ideas? And I said, well, I've got one, you know, you can take a look at this and we'll see how it works. And it worked out. I designed it. I took the painting and then designed the font and everything, you know. Well, I didn't design the font of Helvetica, but I designed where it goes and kind of moved things around and made sure.
So that's a lot of control about the way it looks, the way your book looks.
And I think they were happy because it was less responsibility for them. You know, they didn't have to pay a designer to do it. And it gives me the control to make it look the way I want. The first one, Poplandia, the art is by a guy named Tim Fielder. He's a graphic novelist out of Harlem. And I got to meet him at a conference at MIT years ago, and we hit it off, and we've been friends. He came to Eastern. I brought him in to promote a book, and he was saying, you know, when you get your book together, let me know. I'll do the cover. And I said, right. You know, that's not going to happen, whatever. And he would be, you know, every 6 months, email me, hey, man, you got it going on yet? You got that book ready? And he was talking to my wife, hey, you got to kick him in the butt, man, make him get his stuff together.
And that's what made you get this, and finally so, send the manuscript out?
Yeah.
Because the artist was like, come on, man. And I so, love that.
So when they accepted it, I emailed him, said, are you still up for it? And he was like, well, I've got a lot going on, but give it to me now, and I can do it in the next couple of weeks. And so he came up with it probably in a week and a half. I sent him the manuscript. He read it, designed the cover art, which he says he described as the poster for an Elvis movie if he had continued making movies rather than dying, like an 80s B sci-fi movie poster.
It definitely, can you describe it visually? Because we've got a rainbow in the top third.
We've got like some kind like, of, it's we got Elvis.
Elvis
Elvis-esque
Central.
Picture of somebody. with some flying saucers at the top, rainbow things shooting out of his eyes, and doing his sort of kung fu Elvis stance in his white jumpsuit. There's a couple poems in the book about Elvis, one way or another. And he grew up in rural Mississippi, northern Mississippi, not too far from Tupelo. So he was like, hey, man, Elvis was my backyard was there. You know, everybody talked about Elvis all the time. Let me do it like this. Sent it to me, and he sent me an early draft that wasn't done. And I was like, this is good enough the way it is. Don't change it. And then he kept making it better and better and better. And I was like, oh, I don't deserve, it's better than the poetry inside, probably.
That's wonderful. Like this, talking about this collaboration, mm-hmm. you know, like, so you've got your manuscript, your book of poems, and now you're also collaborating somebody who finds something connections that they're making something with too.
That's right.
That's wonderful, Andre. Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. I really need to mention this a couple of times though, because tomorrow you're going to be reading at Literati Bookstore.
At Schuller's.
Sorry. Tomorrow at 6:30 at Schuller's, Andre Pelletier will be reading from Petoskey Stones at Schuller's over by the Westgate Market.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of town. Let's take a short break now, and then we'll be back. Today, Andre Pelletier is here, and you've got Living Writers.
Yes, she followed me around from Ohio.
Welcome back. You're just in time because we're in the last few minutes of Living Writers today with Andre F. Pelletier. But never fear, because tomorrow is the official book launch of the book we've been talking about today, Petoskey Stones, out with Finishing Line Press. Andre will be at Schuller's tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Schuller's bookstore out in Westgate Market. So, Andre, would you mind? We were talking before the break about Elvis on
we
the
were.
Cover of Puplandia. Could you read one of your poems about Elvis for us?
This one's called Graceland. It's about the time I went to Graceland with my wife and her mother about 12 years ago, maybe. Graceland. South from Dongola, we drove through the sunsets and fireworks to the dawn of rock and roll. North from Tupelo, he rode in on the wings of angels, while seraphim sang, "Son, that girl you're fooling with, she ain't no good for you." Memphis at dawn, crossing the river and crossing the line, Hernando de Soto slept here and died here on the banks. Down in the delta, de Soto, Castilian giant of a man, died and was buried among the reeds and the crocodiles. Memphis, too, has buried kings. North from Tupelo, he took care of business. We wandered the ground, saw the gaudy Christmas tree and the maize and blue television room. We toured the Lisa Marie and the racquetball court. We passed the bar to get to the racquetball court. In the garden, a young woman wept at his grave. Elvis was long dead by the time she was born, but she wept. Perhaps she listened to his old records with her grandfather. Blue Moon of Kentucky, brown-eyed handsome man, blue suede shoes. Perhaps they listened while she sat on his lap. He smoked his cigarettes and bobbed his head while she stared into his eyes and loved him. He made her peanut butter and banana sandwiches as they listened to Heartbreak Hotel and worked in the garden. He smelled of aftershave and Beeman's. She rolled with laughter as he tried to emulate the great hip shake to the sounds of Hound Dog. He never caught a rabbit, but she loved him anyway, and she wept at the grave of Elvis Presley.
Thanks.
There you go. There's one of my Elvis poems.
Thanks, Andre. It's lovely how you go from a moment, like a real concrete description of Graceland, into imagining the life of this young woman.
This is probably, like I said, maybe 12 years ago. She was probably 25, maybe. And I remember looking and thinking, what kind of connection could she possibly have? Like, it's interesting to see. You know, people just know Elvis, but the way she wept, I couldn't fathom. And then I sort of like, well, what could it be? I bet it's not just Elvis. There's something else going on. Maybe, you know.
And then you found her grandfather.
Oh, no, that's all made up.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
But you found the idea of her grandfather.
Yeah.
And was that because it was something that you connected to with your own, or was it purely just this character imagined?
A little bit. I do remember, you know, showing up at my grandparents' house in Florida, and one night we got there late, and we went into the back room, my father, myself, and my grandfather, and listened to his old records. Now, they weren't Elvis records, because he was a lot older than that, you know, but they were like big band and Dixieland jazz albums. I remember specifically listening to Chattanooga Choo Choo, because we had just driven through Chattanooga, you know, so it was like fresh on my mind. And sitting there listening to these old albums with my dad and my grandfather, and it always has sort of resonated, that idea. Yeah.
Did he, and maybe this is too direct of did he ever make you a peanut butter and banana sandwich? Because I loved that detail.
No,
it stands out
but
to me.
If you go to Graceland, that was Elvis's favorite food, and there's like recipes for Elvis's peanut butter and banana sandwich all over the place. Like, it's peanut butter and banana. I don't know why we really need a recipe.
But I'm showing the holes in my Elvis knowledge for sure.
But apparently, this is kind of weird, I thought, he crushed up the bananas and mixed them with the peanut butter before putting it on the bread.
Oh, so like a paste.
Yeah, like that's just the extra work. It's all, I don't know why you do that.
It's all pretty mushy.
And the other thing, though, was the bar going to the gym. that Elvis had put a bar into the gym. So you had to go through the bar just to get to the workout area.
So would you get like a drink on the way sort of thing?
I would think that that's my kind of workout. I don't
know. That sounds really good. All right, Elvis.
It was such a strange place.
I mean, I can imagine. Well, I can. Thanks for all the details, too. And yeah, anyone who wears a spangled jumpsuit is all right with me. Andre, thank you so much for coming here today. Before you go tomorrow to Schuler's Books for your book launch, the official book launch of Petoskey Stones, out this September. Andre, thanks again for coming to Living Writers, and it's been lovely to talk with you today. And
thank you so much for having me. It's been great, and this has been absolutely a blast.
And kind of you again to bring your energy to WCBN today and your poems and all your books of poems that were so good to see on the table. And thanks to all you out there for listening today. Take good care. And thanks to Jason for engineering for us. And thanks, Mom, for listening.
Thank you all.
I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Hello, it is 6 p.m. here in Ann Arbor on WCBN FM Ann Arbor, which means it's time for the Daily Sports Report. I'm Alex Miller, Jake Singer, and Charlie Lentz joining me for this one on a fine Wednesday. Still warm here in November in Ann Arbor. Can't say much more than that about the weather. So we'll talk basketball today, men's and women's hoops. Season's getting underway. I mean, so far what we've seen, I think, has been nothing but exciting. We can start with men's, maybe half the show, then we'll flip it over to the women's side. Men's side, largely a destruction of Cleveland State to open the regular season. I thought they played some really good basketball. What Dusty May has talked about, playing fast, pushing in transition. That's what this team has done, and they're moving the ball, getting out. It's looked good.
It's definitely looked good. I mean, this Michigan basketball team has a lot of depth on it. And as you said, Dusty May, first-time head coach this year, coming in, bringing in six transfers, three freshmen. You saw a 10-man lineup really for majority of the game. Every player that was available to play got in the game at some point in that game against Cleveland State. You saw, you know, even the walk-ons get some traction at the end of that game too. So it was definitely a great all-around showing. As you said, Alex, it's a very small sample size. It's only one game, but the bar was very low after last year with Juwan Howard, and so far it's been pretty exciting to watch.
Yeah, for sure. Going from the preseason game with Toledo, I was having a little bit of concerns because I did not realize that the big men were struggling a little bit too much there, but sitting front row of the game right behind the bench, I was truly amazed by the way they pushed the ball in transition. I think it was almost like 24-2 for transition points and everything. And then the way they got down the floor, you had Will Shedder and Danny Golden, everyone getting up at the rim. Everyone was pushing it. And as you said, the rookies, LJ Kaysen, even Fat Fat Brooks getting a little bit of minutes there. It was truly an all-around performance. We did see Vladimir Golden struggle a little bit, had around like a 0-0-0 stat line. But even he contributed.